The headlines: United Nations warns that Somalia's rapidly worsening drought has left more than 2 million people facing severe food and water shortages. Britain says it's banned Palestinian resistance movement Hamas as a terrorist group. Hamas says the move shows London's submission to Israeli blackmail and dictations. And in Hungary, the number of daily COVID-19 cases climbs to its highest the highest since the start of the pandemic, as the country registers 135 new deaths. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story: the United Nations raises the alarm on drought in Somalia, saying over 2 million people face severe food and water shortages in the African country. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says the drought has already forced nearly 1,000 Somalis to flee their homes in search of food and water. The body cautions about a fourth consecutive season of poor rainfall in the country, describing climate change as one of the main drivers. Meanwhile, Somali officials are warning that more people could face starvation as they lose their livestock and slide deeper into poverty. This comes as the Horn of Africa has experienced more than 30 climate-related hazards since 1990, including 12 droughts and 19 floods. Well, Saudi Arabia is ramping up its aggression against neighboring Yemen. The kingdom carries out fresh airstrikes against the war-torn country, leaving several casualties. Multiple positions in at least 7 provinces, including Sana'a, Sa'ada, Hudaydah, and Ma'rib, were targeted overnight. The air raids left 1 civilian dead and 2 others injured in Hudaydah. 3 civilians are also rather wounded in Sa'ada. Yemen's Ansar movement has condemned the attacks, warning that Riyadh will face the consequences. The Yemeni army has also vowed not to let the attacks go unanswered. Riyadh and its allies launched a war against Yemen in March 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Tens of thousands of Yemenis have been killed and millions more displaced as a result. Iran's foreign ministry warns against attempts to use the International Atomic Energy Agency as a tool to exert pressure on other countries. The ministry said such moves do more harm than good to the perpetrators, as they hurt the agency's legitimacy as a technical and specialized body. It urged that the IAEA's decisions should not raise suspicions of political motivations. This follows France's Thursday statement urging the IAEA's Board of Governors to send a strong message to Tehran. The statement cites a recent IAEA report complaining that Tehran has not fully cooperated with its inspectors. The agency's Board of Governors will meet next week ahead of a new round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal. Thousands of people, including farmers, gather in Iran's central city of Isfahan to protest actions resulting in a major river drying up there. The protest took place on the banks and barren riverbed of the Zayanderud, which has lost almost all of its water in recent years. The demonstrators are critical of dam construction and the development of water-intensive industries. They also blame the redistribution of Zayanderud's water to other cities for its arid state. In response, the Iranian first vice president ordered energy and agriculture ministers to take immediate measures to tackle the issue. Mohammad Mokhber acknowledged the difficult conditions, adding that the government is seriously seeking a solution. The number of deaths and infections from the novel coronavirus is shrinking in Iran as the government is speeding up the vaccination drive. Health officials have reported some 5,800 new cases. Over the past day, 100 COVID-related deaths have been recorded in the same period. Meanwhile, more than 101,000 doses of COVID vaccines have been injected as the process is accelerating. Containing the pandemic, increasing the imports of vaccines, and speeding up the vaccination campaign have been among top priorities of the new government in Iran. European countries are tightening curbs to control their rising COVID infections, with some states reimposing or considering full lockdowns to battle the surge. Austria becomes the first Western country, or European country, that is, to reimpose a national lockdown. It says a measure will take effect on Monday. The country also plans to make COVID vaccinations mandatory as of February 1st next year. Germany is considering similar measures as well. The government says the COVID situation there is so grave that a full lockdown, even for the vaccinated, cannot be ruled out. It says that Germany is facing a national emergency. Other European countries are also tightening the restrictions as cases surge across the continent. On Friday, Hungary registered its highest daily case tally since the start of the pandemic. Russia logged a new record in its daily deaths. Tensions remain high between France and the UK over fishing rights in the English Channel. Now Paris says it will not back down from its demand of having the same number of licenses. France's Europe minister says the British Channel island of Jersey must grant all outstanding requests for post-Brexit licenses to French fishermen. Clement Bonneau said Paris would continue negotiations as well as pressure. The two sides have been at odds over the number of licenses the UK allocated to French fishing boats after its departure from the European Union. Paris says many requests have been denied, while London says it's respecting the Brexit deal. France has threatened to prevent British boats from offloading their catches at its ports. China condemns the opening of a de facto Taiwanese embassy in Lithuania amid escalating tensions between Beijing and Taipei. The Chinese Foreign Ministry called the move an extremely egregious act that defies the One China rule. It reiterated Beijing's position on Taiwan as an inalienable part of China's territory, saying any move to seek independence is doomed to fail. China also demanded that Lithuania immediately correct its wrong decision. On Thursday, Taipei said it has formally opened an office in Lithuania using the name Taiwan. In July, Lithuania revealed an agreement to let Taiwan open what it assumed as a new diplomatic outpost in Europe. China then responded by withdrawing its ambassador to Vilnius. On this segment of the program, Britain says it has banned Palestinian resistance movement Hamas in its entirety following the suit of the United States and the European Union. The UK Interior Minister claimed that Hamas has, quote, significant terrorist capability, including access to extensive and sophisticated weaponry. Priti Patel, however, did not make any reference to Israel's deadly attacks against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Tel Aviv welcomed the move, which Hamas slammed as biased toward the Israeli regime. Senior Hamas official Sami Abu Zohri said the designation is, in fact, London's submission to Israeli blackmail and dictations. He said the group has the right to resist against Israeli occupation by all available means, including armed resistance. London banned the military wing of Hamas known as the Izzeddin al-Qassam Brigades back in 2001. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have our correspondent Robert Carter, who's with us from the British capital, London. Also joining us from London, Ontario, we have international human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Robert in the British capital. Talk to us more about this decision by the UK, which was announced by the UK Interior Minister.
Sure. Well, obviously, it is a move which may have surprised some simply because it was announced quite abruptly this afternoon. However, if you look at the direction in which the current government has been taking British foreign policy in regards to the Israel-Palestine conflict, then you can see a trend of becoming more radical, more extreme in its support of Israel over the demands and the needs of the Palestinian side. Now, Home Secretary Priti Patel herself is a very well-known and established supporter of Israel. She actually compromised her political career in 2017 after being embroiled in a row over illegal and rule-breaking trips to Israel, where she engaged in private conversations where it turned out that actually political matters with Israeli politicians was also being discussed at these meetings, which shouldn't have been allowed to take place. She decided to carry on with that track, and now she's back in government. She's continued on that trend of being pro-Israel in her policy making. But also, I think worth noting is a report that was revealed by Declassified UK, an independent journalism platform based here in the UK, revealed a study last May that revealed that up to a third of the current government, including the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, has received money over the years, either coming out of Israel itself or from several pro-Israel groups and organizations which are active both here in the UK or over there in Israel. So this idea that the UK would take what is essentially a very undemocratic position in regards to the elected organization Hamas in the Gaza Strip isn't that much of a surprise if you look at the track record of the politicians which are currently leading this country. They've made clear they're pro-Israel, they're going to support Israel, and this is just one example of where they can come and do a favor for the regime in Tel Aviv, which they've made very clear they're happy to do over the last couple of years.
Edward Corrigan, what are your thoughts on this designation? A senior Hamas official has said that this is in fact London's submission to Israeli blackmail and dictations. Do you agree with that?
In part, I agree with it, but it's also true that Britain has had a long-standing agenda with regard, and it's very anti-Palestinian, with regard to the Balfour Declaration, regard to, you know, the British mandate, and of course where the British, to a large extent, facilitated, you know, Zionist immigration into to Palestine. So the British have their own agenda on here as well. But it clearly is anti-democratic, because Hamas is the most popular political party within the Palestinian movement. It's more popular right now than Fatah is. And you have, you know, it's a way of delegitimizing it. But, you know, we have to remember that Menachem Begin and Israel Shamir were both designated as terrorists by the British government when they were resisting the British occupation in Palestine back in the mandate period. And you also have to recognize that, in fact, Israel was the organization that helped create Hamas in order to divide the Palestinians into a religious stream and a secular stream, so they could use the Hamas to undermine and to, you know, work against the Fatah and the PLO. So it is complex, but you can't. There's, you know, Hezbollah. Every party in Lebanon is sort of tied to a religious community. Every party in Israel almost is tied to some sort of religious component. And, you know, you have even like the Christian Democrats and parties in Europe that also have, you know, at least historically, you know, a strong element of, you know, religion behind their sort of their policy and their legitimacy. So it is clearly anti-democratic. And of course, you know, the Hamas is right that they have the right to resist against, you know, the Israeli occupation, the Israeli blockade, and of course the repeated Israeli attacks against the Palestinian people, which of course, you know, the British are deaf to. But it really points to the weakness in sort of the pro-Palestinian, the pro-Arab, pro-Muslim community in England, that they are, you know, not, don't have any political impact. And of course the government of England and Prime Minister Johnson can totally ignore them and, you know, delegitimize them as well, even though they do represent a very large portion of the electorate in Great Britain. And of course you've seen this the fight within the Labour Party, where you had, you know, people like the Mayor of London, Jeremy Corbyn, you know, who were expressing pro-Palestinian views, but they were attacked by the media, attacked by pro-Zionist organizations. And, you know, it's clear that the Zionists have, you know, almost a lock on British politics, even though there is independent Jewish voices and a lot of, you know, principled, you know, religious Jewish figures and academics that speak out against Israel's aggression against the Palestinians.
Robert, there was a comment here as the UK Interior Minister who claimed that Hamas has, quote, significant terrorist capability, including access to extensive and sophisticated weaponry. That's a puzzling comment. It's borderline humorous when we look at the disparity of the death toll and the figures killed during the Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip and against Hamas and the arm wing, the Izzedine Al-Qassam brigades. The disparity is it's alarming, it's asymmetrical, and we see comments like this, and let's not forget the hundreds of millions of dollars of military support that the Israeli regime is receiving from the United States, where are these kinds of comments coming from?
Well, it is an interesting point you bring up there, because the armed wing of the movement has already been branded as a terrorist organization in the UK. That happened many years ago. What this latest designation is targeting is the political wing of the organization. So its entirety, all wings, will now be branded as a terrorist organization. But, you know, that comment makes no sense, because that's referring to the armed wing of Hamas, which is already a terrorist organization. So what the Home Secretary and the government appear to be doing is conflating the issue. They're not differentiating, which historically they have done, between the political side of the group and the military wing of the group. And what does that represent? That represents the attack on democracy, the fact that the UK is not a defender of democracy worldwide and is not advocating for a political solution to the situation in Palestine, which is something that they claim to do on another occasion. So what this highlights is the hypocrisy of the UK. It highlights the fact that, you know, the UK is apparently supporting what has been accused of being a colonialist project in Palestine. This latest development seems to enhance and reaffirm those accusations which are made by Palestinians themselves against the UK. But also, what I will mention very briefly is that I fear that this designation is not just about Hamas. If we put them to one side for a moment, what this new law will potentially allow is for crackdowns on Palestinian advocacy groups here in the UK. What do I mean? Any group that supports Palestine, that is Palestinian, that advocates for Palestine, they could potentially be smeared, perhaps. Some kind of vague, trumped-up charges of being linked or supporting Hamas in some way could be brought up, and then potentially that organization could be shut down on essentially trumped-up charges of supporting a terrorist group. Attempts like that have been made against Palestinian groups in the past and have failed by and large, including against the BDS movement or Palestine Solidarity Campaign, for example. But this could potentially bring that smear or character assassination trick back into the mainstream. So I'm very fearful about the Palestinian cause going forward here in the UK.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Robert Carter, our correspondent, joining us from London. And thanks to international human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan, joining us from Ontario. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Stick around. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
This is A to Z. an introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, being religious. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of being religious. What does it mean and what effects does it have in our lifestyle when we talk about the Islamic lifestyle? Does being religious an important thing or not? Or can someone who's not religious have or adopt the Islamic lifestyle and reach to perfection? Now, one thing which we need to bear in our minds that when we are talking about the lifestyle and especially Islamic lifestyle, it is to take us, this lifestyle will take us towards the perfection, which is known as sa'adat in Arabic. So the word sa'adat in Arabic means that you reach to perfection, you have a good life in this world and a good ending in hereafter. This does not mean that you are suffering in this life, in this world, in order to get a better life in hereafter. No. Sa'adat or success or perfection means that you had a good life, a successful life in this world, and you have a good and successful life in hereafter. So when we talk about the lifestyle and we talk about being religious, it does not mean that a person who does not follow religion, who's not religious, can reach to perfection. Now, why do we say so? It is because that being religious is being negatively translated or defined in the general life, in the West especially. In the West they say like the being religious means you're so much conservative and you just do what you think and what religion says. You do not enjoy your life, you do not communicate with people so much because you're religious, and being religious means that you live alone and you do not socialize.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of being religious, and we said generally in the West, or generally people, they think like being religious means that you live alone, you do not socialize in people, you're very conservative, and you do not socialize in a way that the others do, and you do not even enjoy your life. You do not have any entertainment or enjoyment in your life. This is a concept that is generally given for a person who is being religious. Now, let's look at the Islamic lifestyle. When we talk about the Islamic lifestyle and the being religious in Islam, what does it mean? It means that you do not disobey Allah Almighty, and that's it. This is the simplest definition of being religious. Being religious means that you do not disobey Allah Almighty. For example, if Allah has forbidden the alcohol, then you do not go towards alcohol. If Allah has forbidden the mixed gathering marriages or the places where there's a mixed gathering, the mixed gathering itself is not a bad thing. But the problem is if you see people are dressed in a way which is forbidden, or if they are not basically having the veils, and the place where you're going, it's not suitable for you, then obviously you avoid such things. So this is what it means, actually, being religious, that you do not disobey Allah. If Allah has said to eat halal, you go for halal foods only. You do not go for haram. But it does not mean that you do not enjoy your life. You enjoy through the halal means. That's what it means, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/E and Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
We get people.
The U.S. is still maintaining its broken immigration policy, even during the administration of Democratic President Joe Biden. In the previous administration, the left-wing-leaning media kept criticizing President Donald Trump for his crackdown on so-called illegal aliens, keeping children in cages, families separated, and trying to build a wall on the border with Mexico. Now, while the government is now safely distant from that media hype, not much has changed. Apprehending and removing undocumented immigrants who are considered a threat to national security and public safety of the U.S. continues unabated in a country claiming to be leader of the free world.
Immigration under Biden.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, And in this episode, we'll try to search for any end in sight on the issue of immigration, its victims and its enforcers, and broken policies creating the stalemate we are witnessing nowadays. My first guest in this episode will be journalist and author Daniel Lazar. And later on the show, I'll be joined by activist and commentator Don DeBar. Please stay with us as we delve into the ups and downs of the issue and do our best to shed light on how the situation could pan out for immigrants, refugees, and asylum seekers in America.
Immigration has always been essential to America. Let's end our exhausting war over immigration. For more than 30 years, politicians have talked about immigration reform, and we've done nothing about it. It's time to fix it. On day one of my presidency, I kept my commitment and sent a comprehensive immigration bill to the United States Congress. If you believe we need to secure the border, pass it because it has a lot of money for high-tech border security. If you believe in a pathway to citizenship, pass it. It's over 11 million undocumented folks, the vast majority of here overstaying visas. Pass it. We can actually, if you actually want to solve a problem, I've sent a bill to take a close look at it.
Now, previously we asked Mr. Lazar what he thinks the fact that migrants and refugee seekers' deaths at the U.S. southern border with Mexico has reached an all-time high. What exactly does that mean for Washington's continued claims of promoting human rights throughout the world?
Well, it certainly undercuts any U.S. claims to be enforcing human rights. The U.S. is pursuing extremely unjust policies with regard to immigration and internal economic development in the countries that are hardest hit in the Caribbean and in Central America. And the U.S., to a great extent, is actually causing these problems that it now is wrestling with.
The U.S. southern border continues to be the epicenter of crackdown on asylum seekers and refugees. But their plight extends further into the country, where they continue to face harassment and fears of deportation. Even those who have been on U.S. soil for generations and contributed to the country's well-being are not exempt from suffering.
There is no easy solution to migration because it's the interaction of different vulnerabilities. The violence, the lack of opportunities, you know, the vulnerability to natural disasters.
The Biden administration has not offered any practical shift in the U.S. anti-immigration policies and basically continues pushing the same policies regardless of the Democrats' full control over the country.
Earlier, we asked our guest Don DeBar that given the profound instability in some of the Caribbean and Latin nations, how he thinks the fate of the refugee seekers and migrants is going to pan out.
You know, the first thing is, you know, what's broken and what's fixed and how is it supposed to function? Essentially, the immigration into the United States and into the European Union, you know, also I assume into places like Japan and South Korea and Australia, places where there aren't wars being conducted right now and or death squads chasing people around, that those are magnets for people that are suffering the results of imperialism and U.S. foreign policy. People are being driven out of their homes because the conditions in their countries are intolerable as a direct consequence of colonial relations economically, imperial relations politically, and pretty much fascistic policies by the comprador governments that are placed in power by the U.S. and European colonial powers.
So hypocrisy prevails in U.S. politics as before, and the issue of immigration is no exception. Migrants keep being subjected to inhumane tactics, such as Donald Trump's Remain in Mexico program. Now, Joe Biden had vowed to compensate families of children separated from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border throughout the Trump administration, a pledge which remains to be materialized to this very day.
In balance, I would say that Trump's policies were maybe slightly worse, but the difference is really insignificant, and Biden has essentially pursued much the same policies. The problem is that the U.S. has devastated the Haitian economy, It has supported a coup d'etat. It has encouraged the growth of drug gangs due to its highly punitive approach to the war on drugs. And at the same time, it forbids Haitians to immigrate. Now, the U.S. has pursued some of the same policies in Puerto Rico, which is also located in the Caribbean.
The Democratic president also keeps pursuing the Trump policy known as Title 42, which continues to return migrants to an uncertain future in Mexico. Officially called the Migrant Protection Protocols, the program has so far sent over 70,000 people to unsafe cities near the U.S. border in Mexico. Given profound instability in some of the Caribbean and Latin nations, how is the fate of the refugee seekers and migrants going to pan out?
Biden sent 7,000 of them back to Haiti, where they originated. But Haiti is a devastated country where crime is through the roof. Criminal gangs control the countryside. And in fact, it's so bad that American diplomats are forbidden to leave the embassy grounds because doing so is simply too dangerous. So that actually surpasses anything that Trump did. It was a major crime against humanity.
Title 42 expulsions are just the tip of the iceberg in the U.S. crackdown on immigrants. In his first 6 months in office, Biden has exceedingly used that authority and even broken Trump's record in the quest to suppress immigrants at the southern border. The U.S. government boasted about payments of around $450,000 to compensate the brutal family separation practice. But now it has not only changed that figure, but also cast aspersions on whether it would be paid at all.
Now, the crisis at the border is a telltale of the human rights situation in America. Putting kids in cages or so-called migrant facilities represents the depth of U.S. politicians' disregard for children who actually never chose to enter the country on their own. And the Trump administration was notorious for exercising zero tolerance at the U.S. border with Mexico. So what is the difference between the Trump administration and the current one in terms of dealing with migration at the southern border?
But primarily the media coverage. People are being sent back. You know, Obama was the great deporter. He actually sent back more people than Trump did by, I think, a factor of two or three, I forget. Not just because of his 8 years to 4 years, but actually in terms of, you know, per year. He sent more people back than Trump did. And Trump's numbers went down after securing the border in the first group under his administration, as opposed to the way it had been secured under Obama or Bush or Clinton.
The story of immigration into the United States has been laced with continuous reports of illegal crossings, detentions, and even murder and sexual abuse.
The situation facing people that leave a precarious situation in the Caribbean and Latin American countries are going to come to the United States and find also a precarious situation for themselves, with the exception of the compradors, the people that moved to Cuba, for example, after the Cuban Revolution, or the people that moved to Miami from Cuba, and the people that moved to Miami from Venezuela after 1998, the people that moved to Miami from Nicaragua, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those people do very well when they get here, or some of them do.
Now, whether or not they get in, most end up disillusioned at the conclusion of their journey. Life is certainly not pleasant for a large number of immigrants, no matter whether they enter the country legally or illegally, or those falling victim to gangs and cartels on the way. What do you personally think is next in the fight for immigrants' rights, and where do you see the U.S. government heading in dealing with this issue?
If there was some way to organically connect working people in the world, communicate directly with each other, And someone asked me this question, knowing that, you know, it might be an input into the policy of people around the world. I would say, first thing that has to happen is that workers in every place, whether they're in the United States or in Honduras or in Haiti or in Africa or in Belgium, have an interest that is distinct from that of the elite. None of us have an interest that identifies with the elite. And so where we find ourselves ignoring what the elite is doing to people in of the places I just mentioned, then we are already going to lose.
Republican politicians keep linking immigration into America to rising crime rates in the country. In fact, speaking about the issue, which is often laced with racism, is a talking point for the GOP officials to score political points ahead of the 2022 midterms and the 2024 presidential election. This is why U.S. imperialist policies have been touted as the main cause for Central American struggle for decades, which has led to influx of migrants at the border.
Their claim by one party over another to be concerned about the deaths of migrants and to be concerned about the lives of migrants, the lie is given to it by these statistics. These numbers have been pretty much constant, you know, within certain fractions on one side or the other, no matter if it were George Bush or Barack Obama or Donald Trump as president, regardless of all the rhetoric that goes around the issue.
Now, the federal government and states such as Texas are meanwhile locked in fierce battles over the number of arrivals at the U.S.-Mexico border, by which southern states are immediately affected. How do you think the more progressive factions of the Democratic Party should react to the Biden administration's deportation of Haitians?
They should react not only by opposing deportations, but demanding comprehensive reform of U.S. economic policies, military policies, drug war policies, etc., in the Caribbean and in Central America. But they are not going to do that. They're just way too weak and way too narrowly focused to do anything like that. But that's what's needed, though.
Biden created a task force after taking office to address some of the brutal policies of the former presidents. Yet a whole lot of the pledges are still blowing in the wind. Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy may have officially ended, but not much hope is in sight for families of migrants as the more sophisticated anti-immigration practices persist. Crossing the border illegally, meanwhile, remains the final solution for people escaping violence, poverty, and insecurity in certain countries of Central and Southern America.
Biden's policies are very bad. Biden represents a continuation of the policies of the last half century, which have had a devastating effect on the Caribbean, on Central America, etc. Not only has the U.S. supported dictators and coups, etc., but the U.S. economic policies have also had a devastating consequence. For example, Haitian agriculture has been destroyed by cheap U.S. imports, and Haiti essentially is not allowed to impose any kind of import restrictions due to intense pressure from U.S.-controlled agencies like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank.
Hoping to reach a land where so-called human rights are promoted on a daily basis, refugees are confronted with an iron fist. So where do you think the American public stands about the Biden administration's handling of migration, given the fact that the nation was built by slaves and migrants in the first place?
Upon a genocide. First, they had to clear the land of the people that lived here. And then they had immigrants come. Some were induced or enticed into coming in one way or another. And others were just captured and dragged over here in chains. There's no question about the moral basis of opposition to immigration being, bad. There is no moral basis for it. Certainly no moral basis for anyone in the United States outside of the people who are indigenous to this continent. But you know, it's a more complex problem than just saying that, you know, this group is right for saying immigrants should have free, you know, access in and out of the country, and this group is wrong for saying that they shouldn't. Because what in fact has happened is that you've had an attack on the people outside of the country in various nations. Again, Central and South America we're talking about here, primarily in the Caribbean, but this has been going on in Africa and Asia as well. And
the issue of immigration, like many other issues, has been extremely politicized. Trump once said that he proudly gave secure borders to Biden despite the current situation. He even suggested that he created a smooth running system on autopilot at the border, which Biden has now broken.
Well, I see the U.S. government heading towards more and more repressive measures and doing nothing, absolutely nothing, to reform its economic, military, and drug war policies in the Caribbean and Central America. I see absolutely nothing happening there. I only see a worsening, in fact. And so, therefore, that means there will be more human suffering, more desperate people on the Texas border fighting to get in, more kids abandoned, just more human horror stories.
Trump's anti-immigration policy was a centerpiece of his 2016 election campaign and is now a major issue as he seeks re-election in 2024. On the other hand, the current presidents appear to have been designed to keep both camps happy. But what about the rights of actual humans amassing at the border? No one really seems to care.
From now on, we have a new segment in our program titled Power to the People, by Abbas Montarem, first part.
Peace, what's going on? My name is Abbas Montarem, and I'm super excited to introduce this new segment of the show called Power to the People. On Power to the People, we're going to be examining the racism that is ingrained throughout this country, right? And if we want to fully understand racism, we have to understand the vehicle that racism has been driven through is settler colonialism, right? So on this episode, we're going to get a full understanding as best as we can in the next few minutes of what settler colonialism is as an ideology, as a practice, as a colonial practice of domination, subjugation, that enacts genocide against indigenous peoples as well as African peoples, right? So the foundation of this country is a settler colony, meaning a foreign people, right? A foreign people from the land, people that the land has no right to, came. In this case, the Europeans came from all over Europe, came to America, enacted genocide on the indigenous people, stole their land, brought with them diseases, rape, pillage, some of the most inhumane crimes against humanity. Is what the Europeans did to America, right? This is why we call them Euro-Americans, because they are Europeans who came and created America, which has no legal or human right to exist based off of genocide, right? Because this is what it is. It's a genocidal country that was founded through the most terroristic acts against humanity. Through settler colonialism, the Europeans stole the land from the indigenous people, and also they stole Africans, they stole us, they stole our people, right? They stole our people from the continent, our ancestral homeland, and forced us to come to the South. Forced us as slaves to come to the South. And it's very important to note that African peoples, we have been resisting ever since the first European came to the continent. Ever since the first European came to the continent, we have resisted the genocidal conditions that the Europeans have tried to bring to our continent and to ourselves as people, right? But we were enslaved in the South through settler colonialism. They brought us as people, as a colony, as a nation of people, as different nations of people, to a colony in the South, and there we have the plantation. So if we want to understand the foundation of American capitalism, if we want to understand the foundation of American settler colonialism, if we want to understand the foundation of American racism, it goes back to settler colonialism and the slave trade and slavery, right? Through slavery, America has become the biggest purveyor of violence. They not only enacted violence on the plantation, but they subjugated us to the economic rule of that. Right? What does that mean? That means that our bodies Our bodies was the first, the biggest amount of capital. Our bodies, before the so-called dollar even existed, our bodies is what existed as capital, right? So the value of slaves was roughly 3 times greater than the total amount invested in banks, and it was equal to about 7 times the total values of all currency in circulation in the country. 3 times the value of the entire livestock population, 12 times the value of the entire U.S. cotton crop, right? And 48 times the total expenditure of the federal government that year. Our bodies. People talk about the New York Stock Exchange. We were the first people traded on the New York Stock Exchange. Not stock, we were the stock. Our bodies was a stock. Our people was a stock. Our languages was a stock. Forcing us to do the labor of this country, to expand this country, right? To expand it to what we know as the so-called 50 United States of America. Banks such as Wells Fargo own slaves. Own slaves as collateral. The foundation of this banking system in America goes back to the enslavement of our people, where these lazy Europeans didn't work and forced us to work through subjugation of the most crimes. These are some of the biggest crimes against humanity, and it must be understood as such. This is the foundation of the economy, and we must understand that the foundation of this economy was our lives, where cotton was the leading American export from 1803 to 1937. What we were forced to pick, cotton, the leading American export. What does that mean? Now, this country is getting rich, is getting wealthy, developing the wealth to then now have more advanced weapons because they enslaved us. They exterminated, they made attempts to exterminate the indigenous people, and they forced Africans through slavery to produce the economics of this country. All this wealth now is used to fund imperialism and to strengthen the military. So if we understand settler colonialism in America, we understand that also Israel, the regime of Israel, has no right to exist. The regime of Israel has no right to exist. It in itself is another settler colony, right? That's why when we connect these dots between what's going on here in America and what's going on in the illegal Zionist Israeli occupation, we see that the Americans, right, the Euro-Americans, the colonizers, the slave owners, right, they're the ones helping fund the Iron Dome. This is by no mistake, right? So we connect these issues with the issues of freeing Palestine to freeing the land here from Euro-American control. So my name is Abbas Muntakeen. Hopefully y'all got a better understanding of what settler colonialism is. And the next episode, we're going to talk some more. So this is Power to the People. I'm Abbas Muntakeen. Tap into the next episode.
Thank you, Abbas, and thank you, viewers, for watching the program. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and make sure you tune in next week when we come back with another episode of We the People. Thanks for joining us, and bye-bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters. 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.